From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Carolyn Hebbard and her search and rescue dogs. Hebbard and her dogs have worked at disaster sites around the world, finding living victims hidden beneath the rubble of earthquakes, hurricanes, and bombings. They've also tracked people lost in the woods and picked up the scent of drowning victims. Also, conservative Catholics. We talk with Mary Jo Weaver about Catholics who identify themselves with the pre-Vatican II Church. Weaver has edited a new collection of essays called Being Right. Her previous book was about women who were Catholic and feminist. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. GOP congressional leaders have split over how and when to return furloughed federal workers to their jobs. Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole says he now favors bringing the workers back with pay for a 7 to 10 day period while budget talks with the president continue. But House Speaker Newt Gingrich says it would be very hard to reopen the government without first having a final agreement on how to balance the budget in 7 years. UPI's Pi Chamberlain reports lawmakers from both parties are discussing the various alternatives.
Congress came back in with few members on hand. Republicans said they'd like to get the 500,000 or so laid off federal workers back to work on the basis that they would eventually be paid. Democrats said that was a decent thing to do, but would still leave the workers facing payless paydays. Democratic Senator Sarbanes of Maryland represents hundreds of thousands of federal workers.
A lot of people need the paycheck in order to pay car payments, house payments, tuition payments.
Democrats blamed Republicans for the problem. Republicans blamed the president for not signing the money bills passed by the Republican Congress and carrying Republican policies. Pi Chamberlain, Capitol Hill.
The man accused of deliberately driving his car into a New Year's Eve crowd in Boston has been released on $1,000 bail. The man allegedly injured 21 people. Prosecutors say he was acting out of frustration because the people weren't getting out of his way. Friends and relatives say the man was acting in self-defense after an unruly crowd attacked his car. A survey of young people in Hong Kong found that 43% of them want to leave before the British colony reverts to Chinese control next year. They voice concerns about the likely loss of freedom and human rights and an increase in corruption that could come with the handover to China. NPR's Mary Kay Magstad has more from Hong Kong.
Hong Kong's youth are almost evenly split about whether the handover to China will mean significant changes to life as they know it. In a survey of more than 1,600 young people, ages 15 to 24, Hong Kong's Chinese university found considerable levels of uncertainty and anxiety. 43% of those surveyed said they'd leave Hong Kong before the handover in June 97 if they could. Some were worried about curtailment of basic freedoms. Others feared that integration with China would mean greater unemployment as more Chinese migrants would be coming into Hong Kong and snapping up jobs. The survey found that most of Hong Kong's young people feel powerless to act against such trends and that only 22% are even aware of their right to vote. I'm Mary Kay Magstad in Hong Kong.
AT&T has announced it will eliminate at least 40,000 jobs as part of its plan to split into three companies. Investors reacted enthusiastically, bidding up AT&T shares, and that has helped boost the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which is currently up just over 49 points in heavy trading. This is NPR News. After being closed for New Year's Day, the stock market has begun its new session on an up note, and investors are hoping for an encore of last year's performance. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed out 1995 at 5,117.12, an increase of nearly 1,300 points on the year. But most analysts don't expect a repeat of last year when the Dow set records 69 times, the most in this century. Frank Grancinelli is a floor trader with Purcell, Graham & Company. He says profits will require a little more work in 1996.
I don't think we're going to see 35-40% on all stocks. I think you have to be a little more selective. You're going to have to pick the good companies and work with it. I mean, you're going to have to do a little more work to make that kind of money. But I think you'll see plenty of 10% gains.
Analysts say there are some signs that bode well for the stock market this year, including an economy that continues to expand and low interest rates. They also say another positive factor for the market is that 1996 is an election year. For all of 1995, Standard & Poor's 500 gained about 34%. The Nasdaq Composite Index soared up nearly 40%. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
Former Interior Secretary James Watt has pleaded guilty to one misdemeanor count for attempting to influence a grand jury investigating the influence peddling scandal at the Department of Housing and Urban Development in the 1980s. At the time, Watt was a lobbyist and a housing consultant. As part of the plea bargain agreement, over a dozen other criminal charges against Watt were dropped. He faces up to 6 months in prison and a $5,000 fine. A private defense research group says there were a record number of so-called little wars around the world last year. The National Defense Council Foundation in Washington says there were 71 such conflicts, ranging from civil wars to border clashes. The group's list even includes the U.S. because of drug violence and organized crime. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I recently met an extraordinary dog who has rescued many people. This German Shepherd named Pasha has sniffed out earthquake victims who were buried under rubble and found people who were lost in the woods. Pasha was trained by an extraordinary woman, my guest Carolyn Hebbard. She's the co-founder of the U.S. Disaster Response Team Canine Unit, whose volunteers respond to catastrophes in foreign countries. She's also co-led Northeast Search and Rescue, a group of handlers and dogs ready to search for missing persons or disaster victims anywhere in the U.S. Hebbard is a trainer and handler. Her new memoir, So That Others May Live, is about her dogs, their search and rescue work, and how that's complicated the other half of her life as the mother of four in suburban New Jersey. Carolyn Hebbard says her dogs are trained to use their sense of smell and then to tell her what they find.
The main factor to understand is they're trained on human scent, not bombs, not narcotics or anything like that. They're trained to find people who are lost. Could be an Alzheimer's patient, could be a lost hunter, lost child. They're trained to find people who have become buried or injured in things like hurricanes, tornadoes, explosions, earthquakes. They're also trained to find people submerged underwater, a drowning victim, and also to locate victims of homicide.
Now, how does your dog know what his mission is? What's expected of him?
I use different commands to a certain extent, but I also use clues. In other words, when the dog is working a disaster, first of all, he can see what's in front of him. Secondly, I don't put a vest or a collar or a leash on him. He's working completely free so he doesn't get injured. If he goes in a boat for a drowning victim, he actually wears an orange life vest. And he can see the water. He knows what's coming. For a homicide search, for instance, I will give a slightly different command to him. And also, before I go into the field, pre-scent him on a material called pseudocorpse, which is made by Sigma, which simulates the odor of a deceased person. So he knows what he's getting into.
Now, you brought your dog Pasha with you, and gosh, he's well-behaved. He's sitting right behind you now, kind of actually lying down, very quiet, very, very professional.
Well, these dogs go through a lot of obedience training, a lot of socialization, and we get them very much used to different environments. First of all, also these dogs fly in cabin on commercial and non-commercial planes, so they have to be well-behaved, and they have to be able to go quite calmly through the chaos of a busy airport.
Now, you train your dogs to recover live victims.
That is their primary purpose.
How do you train a dog to recover a live victim?
It's motivational training. When you first start training a dog, it's the handler, the owner of the dog, who runs off and hides. Somebody else holds the dog. they release the dog, then you play with the dog when he finds you. You gradually increase the distance and the time and add in total strangers who go and hide for the dog. But each time the dog finds, he is rewarded with enormous enthusiasm.
And, yeah, you make it sound like it's a big game for the dog when he's being trained, like he's playing hide-and-seek.
Yes.
And when he finds the person, he gets to play, he gets some food as a reward, and it's a lot of fun.
Exactly. You want the dog to have enormous enthusiasm for a live person, because when you get to, let's say, an earthquake situation where you have both live and dead people, you want the dog to give priority to the live people before he indicates where the dead people are.
Now, in an earthquake, when he actually finds the living victim, the survivor isn't going to give him a little food reward and play with him. So does the dog ever get disappointed and think, I'm not going to play this game anymore. It's just no fun anymore.
No, because one of the things that in training, gradually the victim, we actually have what we call a non-responsive victim, the person who sits there and is obviously alive but doesn't really react very much. And it's up to the handler then who plays with the dog. So in an earthquake situation, after the dog is found, if it's an unstable sort of area that we're in, we wait until we go outside, and then I play with him. But he knows from my voice tone that I am happy.
And you give him food?
No. I don't train with food. Reason being that in a disaster, you have enormous amount of food that's lying around, and you want the dog to ignore that. As a matter of fact, in training, what we do in the rubble pile that we train on, I will hide hamburgers and Kentucky Fried Chicken and things like that, so that in training you can correct the dog from showing interest in that and refocus him on his real purpose.
That's interesting. Yeah, you don't want him searching out the chicken wing instead of the survivor.
Right.
Now, you've done earthquakes in Mexico, Armenia, El Salvador. What can a dog do in an earthquake situation that humans on a rescue team can't?
Well, for one thing, their noses and their sense of hearing are much keener than ours. Yes, we can smell very obvious odors, but a dog's nose is about 500 times stronger than a human nose. And they can also differentiate between live scent and dead scent, even if it's five stories down under crushed cement.
Say a victim is five stories down on a crushed cement, there's a limit to how far the dog can go. Although the dog can probably crawl through places that you couldn't. How far do you let the dog go in an unstable situation, like a collapsed building in an earthquake?
Well, before we commit, we do assess the building structurally as much as we can.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, we usually have someone who's got structural engineering expertise who actually goes with us. You have to think of scent moving in a building like smoke. If I were to release a smoke bomb, the smoke will go through all the little cracks and try and get out to where it can. Now, let's say somebody is five stories down in a pancaked type of building. The dog will indicate, and then we get the rescue workers to, let's say, move as safely as they can, more and more of the debris. Then we bring the same dog or another dog back in, and so that they can pinpoint a little closer as to the location.
Now, how much you believe that a trainer should always follow the dog, go where the dog goes?
I need to watch my dog.
So you'll never let your dog crawl any further than you can get yourself?
No. A dog can crawl in. Like in Kobe, he went way in. But what I did was I belly crawled to a point where with my headlamp I could watch him.
Mm-hmm.
And because also, in a high noise situation, these dogs depend very much on hand signals or whistle blasts
right.
from us.
Now, in an earthquake, there's going to be a lot of dead people as well as survivors who are interred in the rubble. And you want your dog to find the survivors first. And yet, sometimes the dog is going to find dead. Sometimes there aren't any survivors. All the bodies are dead. What's it like for the dog when the dog finds corpses?
Every dog has a different reaction to finding a dead person. It's up to the handler to learn how to read the dog. The moment a person dies, there are definite chemical changes that take place, which the dog can detect, but we can't. Some dogs cringe. Some dogs, the hair on their backs will go up. Ollie, my old dog, his ears would go down, his tail would tuck, he'd have extreme aversion. Pasha sometimes will go and lift a leg 3 feet away from where he found. He'll sniff, he'll whine, and then he's trained to come turn around and bark at me. The reason for this was that too many people had trained their dogs on cadaver. And if you were doing a search for law enforcement and the dog started digging and destroying evidence, you were not a very popular handler.
Right, of course, of course. In your book, you write about, you know, how your dogs get, well, depressed if they find a lot of bodies, dead bodies.
Yes, they do. And even the handlers that I saw in Oklahoma finally realized that, too. And what you have to do at least once a day is to have somebody you're working with or a rescue worker who's willing to do it go hide and give the dogs a live find and just bring them back up. Also, if you have been on a search, a wilderness search, let's say, and the dog has been working all day and the person was not in any of the areas that you covered, the worst thing you can do is to open the back of your truck, shove the dog in his crate, and that's it. What you have to do, I don't care how tired, how cold you are, the first thing you do before that dog is put in his crate is he's given more water and given a live find.
Now, getting back to the depression that the dogs have when they find a lot of dead bodies, is that because, well, you know, they haven't won the game and they haven't gotten the positive rewards, or is it something about the smell of death that really gets to the dogs?
I think it's the smell of death. I mean, I think they instinctively know that this is someone dead. I think one of the Swiss handlers in Mexico City put it very well, because I was worried about the way the four dogs that we were working with started to sort of show an aversion to even getting up and going out in the field. And the man looked at me and he said, look, this is man's best friend, and he's going to get sad if he's finding so many dead best friends. And right. I thought that was very nicely put.
My guest is Carolyn Hebbard, author of a new memoir called So That Others May Live. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Carolyn Hebbard, trains and works with search and rescue dogs. Your dogs are German Shepherds.
Right. Just through personal preference. I have lots of other handlers that I have seen and know, not only in the U.S. but overseas, that have all kinds of different breeds. Goldens, Labradors, Border Collies, Airedales, Schnauzers, and then a wonderful breed that we call the Hardly Can.
What's that?
It's the Hardly Can Tell. You can hardly tell what it is.
The mutt?
It's the mutt, and they make superb search dogs.
That's nice to know. Now, why do you choose German Shepherds? And you literally get them from Germany.
Yes, I do. Ever since I was a child, I wanted a German Shepherd. I think my parents, in their travels, occasionally had friends who had German Shepherds. And there was something very regal, very faithful, and yet very warm about the dog.
They're kind of the officialdom of the dog world because, you know, it's shepherds that are used as seeing eye dogs and police dogs and, you know, they're the authority figures of the dog world.
Well,
watchdogs often.
Well, yeah, nowadays, though, people are using a lot of Rottweilers as watchdogs.
Mm-hmm.
The Seeing Eye in Morristown is using more Golden Retrievers and Labradors than they are German Shepherds.
Because really?
The Shepherds tend to be fairly big dogs.
Huh.
And a lot of police departments are using Labradors and different breeds for their drugs and bomb dogs.
Now, when you brought your dog into our reception area, I noticed a couple of people having the reaction of, like, wanting to, like, rush over and hug the dog and play with it. And then this kind of uncertainty, will the dog bite me or bark at me or, you know, hurt me in any way? Because the dog is so big and obviously so powerful. Would your dog ever turn on someone?
I think he would turn on someone who was physically trying to harm me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think any dog that is bonded to its owner or its family would have the same reaction. He has never been, you know, physically maltreated or teased or anything like that. But I think a natural instinct to protect someone that the dog loves would kick in.
Tell us the story of a time when one of your dogs was in grave danger because of his assignment or because of the, you know, circumstances that the dog was in.
Well, there was one scene where he was nearly shot. This was Ollie. We were actually up at a park trying to find a very poor district that had succumbed to mudslides. And I had to go behind a bush, and I took the dog with me, and all of a sudden he takes off. And I'm running behind him because the way he took off set off warning bells. And as I round the corner, there are some Salvadorian soldiers with their guns pointing straight at him. And so I'm yelling, "Don't shoot, this is a rescue dog." And I'm yelling in Spanish so they would understand. And then I have been in a lot of aftershocks with my dogs. And that, of course, is dangerous to both the human and the animal. But I know I do mention animals will sense an aftershock way before we do.
Really?
And if you can get out in time, because the dog doesn't want to stay underneath a building when he knows one is coming, the dog will give you plenty of warning.
Has that happened to you, where your dog knew before you did?
It did in Mexico. Two of us were with our dogs heading down into an underground garage, and all of a sudden the dogs just started acting strangely. And Linda, the other handler, and I looked at each other, and we said, "Look at these dogs," and we said, "Let's get out." And sure enough, as soon as we got out into the road, things started dropping.
Did that building collapse?
Where we been standing, things were coming down fairly rapidly. And we were trapped once in El Salvador. Couldn't get out in time. And the exit collapsed. It was in a basement. And basically the dog found a way out, came back, and got those of us who were down there out to another end of the building.
Wow. This is like the best episode in the world of Lassie or something. You know, this is,
well,
everybody grew up with this fantasy of having a dog that was so smart and so well trained and so faithful, and that they'd be rescuing people and rescuing you. And that's your dogs.
They're dogs, but when they're home, they can be very normal dogs. They'll chase squirrels. They'll race around the yard.
So your dog is sometimes just a great pet at home.
Oh. When he's not working, absolutely.
I love this idea of the really professional dog who knows when he's on the job and knows when it's, you know, time to play?
Oh, no. I mean, he sleeps at night in the kitchen, and the family has learned not to leave their shoes on the kitchen floor because he will scatter shoes. He plays with them, uh-huh. and they'll be all over the kitchen.
Here he comes. He just stood up and slowly he's walking
fine.
Over to you. Oh, yeah, I'm not, not concerned. No, he's...
But there, no, he's...
He's beautiful.
He's a good boy.
Now, how long have you had Pasha?
I picked up Pasha in Germany in 1991.
I mean, you went scouting all over Germany looking for a dog. Why did you choose Pasha?
Well, after looking at 40 dogs, I don't know how to put it, the light bulb never went on.
Uh-huh.
Either it was the temperament or the way they looked or the way they moved. And it wasn't until I saw Pasha, and he was actually older, because he was already over 2 years old, than what I had anticipated bringing home. But this dog had so much energy, so much enthusiasm, plus I could see from the way he moved that he had good hips, which in your bigger breeds is one of the genetic defects that unfortunately many of them have, having dysplastic hips.
And
Pasha does not have dysplastic hips.
Mm-hmm. Could you tell just by looking at Pasha that he'd be well-disciplined, that he'd learn to take orders well?
He worked very well for his previous owner, so mm-hmm. I knew that could be instilled in him. But I also knew that he would be, that he would challenge me. He would probably be one of the toughest dogs I'd ever had.
Was that true?
Yes.
How did he challenge you?
Rumbling at me, looking at me with this look of, I dare you to make me do this. And it was about 2 months of challenge.
What would he dare you to make him do?
He hated to lie down like he's doing now. The downstay to him was a submissive position, and he did not want to be submissive.
How did you convince him that he needed to assume that position?
Asserting my dominance, forcing him down, and in this case, actually rewarding him with food. I will reward obedience with food.
But not finding a victim.
Exactly.
Carolyn Hebbard's new memoir is called So That Others May Live. She'll be back in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Carolyn Hebbard. She's written a memoir about her work training and handling search and rescue dogs. It's called So That Others May Live. Now, the rewards that you give your dog after they've performed really well on a search mission, will you never give them those rewards in regular life so that the only time they... So that it's just very associated with success at a mission?
That's usually the method that I find works best.
Mm-hmm.
If they're home, then I will throw sticks mm-hmm. or throw balls, but never the burlap roll.
That's a special reward.
That's right. And if he has found, he gets to carry that very proudly all the way back to the car. It's like showing the world that he has accomplished something.
In a way, you've lived a double life, mother of four, and then off around the world on these search and rescue missions, you know, with your dogs in earthquakes and remote hiking trails and all kinds of accidents. And you say that sometimes when you'd go home, you know, the kids wouldn't really be that interested in what happened at the earthquake in Mexico. It was like, I haven't had anybody drive me to my soccer team. I've missed practice. Now get in the car and drive me. And it must have been very disorienting for you. They're two very demanding but very different worlds.
Well, disorienting, I don't think so. I think I came very early on to the realization that basically I had disrupted my children's lives. You know, their normalcy, their routine had been disrupted because of what they considered at that point my hobby. Also, I really, it wasn't until recently when the kids were older that I ever really showed them like slides or pictures or anything of the types of things I went to or even talked about it.
You didn't want them to know the danger you were in.
Right. And it was after they read my book. I remember my oldest daughter calling me up and saying, gee, Mom, we never knew this. And I said, well, would you have wanted to know it at 14? And she said, I guess not.
Didn't part of you want them to know so that they could understand and appreciate what you'd done?
It would have been very hard for them, I think, to understand. We live in a semi-rural, very sheltered community. Certainly they see enough on television. I mean, they would watch television and see scenes from the earthquake. But somehow what you see on television doesn't come as close as if someone who's been there sits down and says, well, I was in this aftershock and things collapsed around me.
Right.
And I don't want them worrying. I had an unsaid rule that when I go on any kind of mission, be it in this country or overseas, I do not call home. If I do call home, something is really wrong.
Why is that your rule?
Otherwise, they would worry if they didn't get a phone call every day.
Oh, of course. Of course.
I don't want their lives ruled by the expectation of that phone call.
Well, here's another thing. I bet you'd find it very hard to cover up the anguish that you were feeling, and you might be in the position of lying to them, saying, yeah, everything's great, when literally things are crumbling all around you.
Right. I talked to them for a certain, you know, to a certain extent on what had happened. I'd give them a little bit of description. But most of what I would describe to them would be in terms of anecdotes, the lighter moments.
Right, right. You've had to put one or two of your dogs to sleep because they got old and disabled. That must be terribly hard to do. I mean, I can't imagine the bond that you must have with your dogs. You not only have all the love that people have for their pets, but you've been in extremely dangerous circumstances. With your pets, they've saved so many lives, and you've been there every step of the way with them.
It's like losing a child, basically. And although I know I do state in my book, and I feel very strongly about this, we are allowed to let our pets, our partners, at least go while they still have dignity. Before they become totally incontinent, totally deaf and blind, or paralyzed, unable to really walk properly. I mean, I know of pet owners that when the hindquarters on their dogs went, they built little trolleys with wheels that they would strap the dog onto so he could pull himself around on his front legs. I can't see doing that to a dignified animal. And when their time to go comes, they go painlessly, and they go with whatever shred of dignity still remains in them intact.
How did you know that it was Ollie's time?
He had become fairly deaf. I knew his eyesight was definitely going. And he had a situation, it's a condition called spondylitis. It's where the nerves in his spinal cord go. So he was losing the use of his back end. And he would walk a few steps and then collapse. And he would lie and pant for hours. If I opened a car door, he used to race for the car.
Mm-hmm.
Now he would just look at it and say, go ahead. And I put him down right before I had to leave for Finland. And I was taking Pasha with me. And I didn't have the heart to kennel Ollie. He hated, even though we have an excellent kennel, he always felt as though I was abandoning him.
Mm-hmm. And why put him through that?
Right.
So do you have to choose a method for putting the dog to sleep?
I go to a veterinarian, one I've been using for years, and I always stay right with my dog mm-hmm. throughout the whole thing. They basically fall asleep on my lap.
Why do you do it that way?
I feel I owe them the courtesy, the love to be with them up till the last moment.
I think some people couldn't face that. You know, with the dog on their lap during this, knowing that it was you putting the dog through it, you know, that...
Everyone has, you know, different ideas on that.
Right.
I couldn't just hand the leash over and not be with the dog till the end.
How old is the dog that you have with you, Pasha?
Pasha is 7 years old, and he'll probably work till he's about 10. And then I'll start gradually phasing him down. Probably I do have a young Czechoslovakian female at home. She's 18 months old and excellent nose, full of energy, but unfortunately has very bad hips. So her working days will be numbered.
You're going to find another dog?
By the end of next year or the spring of 67, I've already put
the 97.
I mean 97, yes. I've already put the word out among the people I know over in Europe. I hope to bring in another young male.
How much longer do you want to do this work?
As long as I'm physically fit and capable of it. I can still out hike some very young guys, so I'm not concerned in that respect.
Good. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure.
Carolyn Hebbard's new memoir about her search and rescue dogs is called So That Others May Live. Coming up, the co-editor of a new anthology about conservative Catholics. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Mary Jo Weaver, is examining the state of Catholicism at the end of the 20th century. After writing a couple of books about feminism and Catholicism, she's co-edited with R. Scott Appleby an anthology of essays by conservative Catholics. It's called Being Right. She counts herself as a Catholic feminist and pluralist. She started the anthology of conservative Catholics, hoping it would open a dialogue between conservatives and liberals within the Church. Weaver is a professor of religious studies at Indiana University. I asked her to define what she means by conservative Catholic.
I think for conservatives, truth is found in the deposit of faith that was given once and for all and doesn't change and is present in the Church. And faithful Catholics follow it by being obedient to the direction of the Pope and observing the rules of the Church. That's what makes them conservatives.
A lot of the conservatives you spoke to really believed that they're not the ones that need to be explained to America. you're the one who has to be explained to America. You're the one, you, the Catholic feminist, you're the one who represents how Catholicism has changed. I think a lot of the conservative Catholics see themselves as having stayed the same while everything around them has changed.
I think that's exactly right. And I think that's exactly how conservative religious people in all traditions feel, that they have stayed steady in a world around them that is changing. And it's a perspective on religion that sees that a religious group or a religious text is a kind of rock and that its job is to stay totally steady and not move and not capitulate to the kinds of challenges that come from its surrounding culture. Liberals in all traditions tend to see those things very differently, and that is that religion is responsive to one's experience and to the experience of the community and to the surrounding culture and so forth.
So is your interest really in that larger division between those who see religion as being what never stays, the thing that is constant, and the others who see religion as something that kind of changes as the times do?
My interest is in the American Catholic Church, and I was inspired by something Bob Wuthnow at Princeton said a few years ago, and that is that religious denominations these days are no longer divided from one another, so Methodists versus Mennonites or Catholics versus Pentecostals, but each denomination is divided internally between liberals and conservatives who are increasingly looking at each other kind of across a chasm and speaking, to use a nice image from Nancy Mayer's, at best pidgin versions of each other's language. So that what happens today is conservative Catholics have more in common, oddly enough, sometimes with conservative Baptists or Pentecostals than they do with liberal Catholics.
Are you trying to start a dialogue between Catholics who describe themselves as liberal and those who would describe themselves as conservative?
That was my original hope, yes. I no longer think that is possible. I mean, I think when I started this, I thought, gee, you know, if somebody who really does not share this mental universe of conservative Catholics, but understands it out of her soul and out of her past, namely me and my wonderful collaborator, Scott Appleby at the University of Notre Dame, if we could gather together some conservatives and some scholars who think about conservative Catholic issues, maybe we really could start some kind of dialogue. Maybe that would lead someplace. Maybe they're right, could be a fruitful discussion here. I am less sanguine about that now that I have spent 2 or 3 years in this project than I was at the beginning.
Have you tried to have a dialogue and felt that that both sides were not understanding each other?
No, what's odd is I think we understand each other perfectly in some ways, and we can't talk. Let me give you an example. A very articulate and I think rather brilliant interpreter of right-wing or traditional Catholicism right now, and we had a conversation, and I was trying to get, it was a woman, I was trying to get a woman to come to one of these meetings where we were all talking together. And she said, well, no, I really can't come. I don't think this is going to be good. You're going to violate me or something. And I went on and I said, well, what would we have to do to get you to spend the weekend at one of these meetings? And she said, you'd have to agree that absolute truth exists, that it's present in the Bible and in the teaching of the Catholic Church, and the job of a Catholic is to follow what the Church says by being obedient to the Pope. And I said, well, you know, if I did that, what would we have to talk about? And she said, if you don't do that, why should we talk? So I think she understands my position, and I understand her position perfectly. And I think although we can be very cordial, we can never kind of get down to cases because we've got very, very different ideas about the nature of the truth, the nature of the Church, what a Catholic is supposed to be or do.
What does that say for the future of the Catholic Church in America if Catholics in America are so divided?
You know, I think one of the mythologies that people operate under is that Catholics were somehow once really all not divided, or that it was a sort of a monolithic group. I think we could pick up the Catholic Church in almost any century, in almost any place, and find radically different kinds of opinions. about God, about the afterlife, about prayer, about children, about sexual moral issues. I think those divisions are a lot more apparent in the American Catholic Church since the Second Vatican Council, 1962 to 65, but I think they've always been there. I think one of the things that makes the Catholic Church interesting and for me intellectually fun is that we do have these kinds of differences of opinion. And that they're both going to be there, liberals and conservatives. Neither group is going to disappear from the church. And both of them can rather profoundly change its direction. And so I think the future of the American Catholic Church is going to have to contend with the intellectual and devotional challenges of both liberals and conservatives. So for me, the point is we can take sides, but we can't dismiss the opposition, left or right, with caricatures.
Now, it seems to me that one of the main differences between conservative and liberal Catholics, the way you've defined them, is that conservatives believe in obedience to the Pope and the hierarchy of the Church, and liberals, obedience isn't what it's about to them, and there are things, possibly divorce or birth control, in which they part company.
That's right.
From the Pope and continue being Catholics in spite of their differences.
I think that's correct. I think one of the dividing lines between liberals and conservatives right now are on a variety of pastoral issues, divorce, homosexuality, birth control. I think abortion maybe not so much, but those three particularly, and also women's ordination. And right now, probably 75% of married Catholics practice artificial birth control in some kind of way. Technically, then, they are totally disobedient to the Pope, who has repeatedly condemned the use of artificial birth control. I don't know what the percentages are, but increasing numbers of Catholics are getting divorced and remarried and not leaving the church. That they're technically, quote, not Catholics in some sort of way. I mean, I think the wrong-headed thing here is to see that being a Catholic requires one to be totally obedient to the Pope. I don't think that's ever been the most important part of a definition of what it means to be Catholic.
But wouldn't some Catholics find what you just said blasphemous?
Absolutely. I think they would. They'd find it heretical. And I think you'll get some letters about this with people saying that obedience to the Pope is exactly the be-all and end-all of what it means to be Catholic. And this goes back to the point I made earlier about the way people look at truth. I mean, I think conservatives, for the most part, aim at truth, and liberals, for the most part, aim at understanding. Conservatives tend to be monolithic. Liberals tend to be pluralistic. So I think they're both trying to understand the mystery of God as they interact with it in their lives in this particular community, but they start out from rather different presuppositions.
My guest is Mary Jo Weaver. She's a professor of religious studies at Indiana University. She co-edited the new anthology, Being Right, Conservative Catholics in America. Let's take a short break and then I'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Mary Jo Weaver. She's the co-editor of the new anthology, Being Right, Conservative Catholics in America. You've done a couple of books about women in Catholicism, feminism in Catholicism. I imagine that you would have been particularly interested in trying to start a dialogue with conservative Catholic women about women's issues and the Church. Were you?
I think I wondered what could happen along those lines. I think that is an issue that probably is less amenable to dialogue than anything I can think of. I think we could have started a dialogue about child rearing. We could have started a dialogue about pastoral responses to broken families and divorce. We could have started a dialogue about the Trinity. Much easier than we could have started a dialogue about feminism, because there again, I think the presuppositions that are brought to this discussion are so radically different and opposed to each other and frankly hostile to each other that I'm not sure that dialogue is possible here. Maybe it's just good for conservative and non-conservative women to get together to see that they really are both pretty normal people. But that's about as far as I can see it going.
You have an essay in your new anthology, Being Right, Conservative Catholics in America, about new conservative Catholic colleges. Why did you want to write about them?
You know, I had not heard of them when I started that project. And a friend of mine at Notre Dame said, well, you know, have you heard of Thomas Aquinas College in Christendom? And I said, no, Magdalen and Thomas More. And I said, no, I haven't. Now, these are colleges that started after the Second Vatican Council to provide a different take on Catholic education. And then there's the College of Steubenville, the kind of a refurbished old diocesan college. All of these places are fascinating. They started with maybe six students and $40,000 and met in an abandoned motel someplace. And now they've got multi-million dollar budgets and campuses and student bodies of 200 or 300, or 100 or 200, I guess would be more accurate. These kids are very interesting to me because most of them are in some kind of great book seminar. They're very articulate. They're very smart. They've worked their way through Aristotle's metaphysics insofar as one can do that, I suppose, as an undergraduate. They have confidence in themselves, in their ability to read a primary text and make an argument and so forth. I think I just found that whole thing, that something like that could happen, extremely interesting. I mean, on the educational front, I think there's a lot of things here that might pay off more in the future. Catholics are increasingly into homeschooling, for example, taking their kids out of the schools and teaching them at home, where they can use the old Baltimore catechisms and the old books from the 50s and teach them the way they were taught, and also do not have to suffer the intrusions of sex education and political correctness. A lot of these kids who go to these colleges have been homeschooled. So I don't know. I thought that was one of the interesting manifestations of the conservative spirit. I also wanted to find it in a young population, because I think a lot of people say, oh, these conservatives are all over 70, give them 10 more years and they'll all be dead. That's not true.
Do you think it's possible that the Catholic Church is going to divide into two different churches?
People talk about that all the time. I don't think that will happen. I don't think that will happen because I don't see how it could work. That is, historically, the Catholic Church has been the church with its seat of authority in Rome, with the Pope, however one may agree or disagree with the person sitting in that office. And if Catholics leave, like a lot of people thought, well, you know, these conservative Catholics are going to be like fundamentalists. Well, they can't be like fundamentalists. Fundamentalists were those people who thought that Protestant churches were not conservative enough, and they left and formed their own church. Well, you can't leave the Catholic Church and form your own Catholic Church. I mean, I think it's oxymoronic to think about it that way. Now, some people say, well, the American bishops could spin off. We could have an American Catholic Church. I doubt very much if that would happen. The bishops are too conservative, for one thing, to do that. Will certain American lay people try to do something? Yeah, I think they do. I think movements like Call to Action and the Women Church Movement and so forth are all embodiments of different kinds of ways to be Catholic. But I don't see those things being able to persist in another generation. I think they tend to be interesting to people who are 40, 50, and 60. I don't think those issues, like the Call to Action issues, are particularly interesting to 18-year-olds or 22-year-olds or 30-year-olds.
Certainly conservative Catholics oppose abortion. How important is abortion to their worldview?
I think anti-abortion activity has now become a locus of the sacred for conservative Christians in general and conservative Catholics in particular. Abortion is murder, in their view. There is no justification for it. It flies in the face of the providence of God and violates a very sacred commandment about life, and therefore it cannot be practiced. And the fact that it's practiced the way it is in this country, I think, has really galvanized and moved many conservatives, especially conservative Catholics, to action. People who didn't have, after the council, they didn't really have a way to protest. I mean, they protested. They didn't like the lack of devotions. They thought that the fact that statues were being taken out of churches was a violation of their heart and soul at some level. But this abortion thing has given them a public access to protest. So to protest, to get arrested, to do things like that, I think that's become a very important marker for a certain segment of the conservative Catholic population.
Mary Jo Weaver. She's co-edited a new anthology of essays by conservative Catholics called Being Right. Her 1986 book, New Catholic Women, has just been published in paperback. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Rena Bander. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.